present the news quiz with your chairman, Simon Hoggart.
Hello and welcome again to the news quiz. We start with an advertisement from the Independent Holiday magazine, read by Charlotte Green.
To let, farmhouse on working farm, sleeps 10 comfortably, bath 25 miles.
And thanks to Brian Wilkes of Leeds for spotting that. Let's meet the teams now. Will you welcome first, on my right, Francis Ween and Steve Punt. And facing them on my left, Alan Corran and Laurie Taylor. And before we start round one, here's an item from the Forest and Wye Valley Review.
Fairways Furnishing offer free delivery and, for old age pensioners, a free erection service.
Thank you, Christopher Robbins of Gloucestershire, for that. Francis, whose sceptical dithering was beyond their ken?
Oh, I think this is another week in the life of the Conservative government, isn't it? Ken Clark said that the government's policy was pathetic. Then another strange man called Sir Nicholas Bunser, I think, turned up and said that Clark ought to be sacked, and then a Tory backbencher said Bunser ought to be sacked, and Major said they'd all misunderstood it because the government had a very clear policy on the single currency, which was not to have a policy. And everything's happy again.
Yes, indeed. There was an outbreak of mad Eurosceptic disease among Tory ministers. Chancellor Kenneth Clark was attacked by Sir Nicholas Bunser of the Foreign Office, or Bunser, F.O., as Mr. Clark calls him. Steve, who whipped out a house guest?
This would be Gerry Adams, wouldn't it?
It would.
And the Labour Party shooting themselves in the knee. Foot, sorry. Yes, Gerry Adams, who represents the political wing of the RA, and two Labour MPs who represent the let's not win the election wing of the Labour Party. But I think they've been much misunderstood. This is Messrs. Jeremy Corbyn and Tony Benn, who invited Gerry Adams to the House of Commons. But as I say, you see, I think they're actually very shrewd, because we do know, after the events of the last week, that the IRA are planning, apparently, allegedly, a new mainland campaign. Now, I think Corbyn and Benn have worked out very cleverly that wherever Gerry Adams is, right? is very much the safest place in Britain. So they phone him up, they say, do you fancy coming over? It's all right, just for a cup of tea and stuff. And Gerry has to make a few hurried phone calls, you know. Lads, have you parked the van yet? Ah, you have. Would you mind just moving it around the corner?
Jeremy Corbyn was threatened with having his whip removed by the Labour leadership, and Adams offered to help. He said he couldn't get a whip, but he did know someone who did a line in baseball bats. Eventually, Adams had to launch his book in traditional Sinn Féin style, out of a metal tube in the back of a stolen Ford Transit. Laurie, who said wait and see by the seaside?
Wait and see. I think the only seaside story that I can remember during the week was something to do with the Liberal Democrats. What the Liberal Democrats were there?
Yes, no, I mean, Alan was trying to help me. I just said, I managed without that, did I? This is the Liberal Democrats. I mean, talking at a very, very important conference, they were talking about putting backbone into the Labour Party, which is, I suppose, rather like putting a cortex into Jeremy Beadle, I should imagine, I mean, in terms of difficulty. You know, putting a life force into Bob Dole, but this was the attempt anyway of the Liberal Democrats to parade themselves as a new party, an alternative to the Labour Party.
Yes, precisely. The Liberal Democrats' annual conference. Delegates also voted for a new carbon tax, a 50% income tax band, and an extra penny on the basic rate. How refreshing to see one party with no pretensions about winning. Paddy Ashton refused to be drawn on whether he would back a Labour government. Commentators detected a new realism in his tone, however, culminating in his great rallying cry, go back to your constituencies and prepare for dinner. Delegates also shrugged off new allegations about the former leader, Jeremy Thorpe. though there was great consternation when a typing error led them to believe that Ashton's patriotic keynote speech would involve wrapping himself in the fag. Alan, listen to this.
There used to be trains, not very quick, got you from place to place, but now there's just jams, half a mile thick. Stay in the human race, I'm walking, they've stuck parking meters outside our doors to greet us. Now things ain't what they used to be.
Alan, who wasn't rusty at talking about corrosion?
It's the Tin Lady, isn't it? The line without the heart. It was an amazing speech because it was full of... She complained that film was desensitizing and brutalizing people. This is someone who for 13 years starred in Pulp Fact and Reservoir Bitch and the Prime Minister from the Prime Minister from the Black Lagoon. Here's a woman talking about the fact that young people today are being desensitized and given hard hearts and not being moral. These are the young people who have grew up through her generation. And she is actually blaming Blur and Quentin Tarantino for doing what's been done to them. It's quite remarkable. I think it's a fact, isn't it?
We were also amazed to learn this week that Mrs. Thatcher said she'd lost faith in John Major just 22 days after he took over as Prime Minister. But then she had been on holiday for the first 3 weeks.
That same thing that was Jeffrey Durbin stuff in the Times, and on day two, he said that she treated the Germans much as Alf Garnett would have done. And there's this wonderful image of this dreadful woman in a West Ham scarf sitting there railing at the Krauts. It put me on her side briefly, but then.
And at the end of round one, the scores are Francis and Steve 4, Alan and Laurie 4. We start round two with an item spotted in World Books magazine.
Robert Ludlum's latest novel, The Cry of the Haladin, combines all his hallmarks. Meticulous research, sparkling narrative, and complex plots. All his old fans, as well as the many new ones, won't fail to be disappointed by it.
Thank you, Stella Sturgeon of Stourbridge, for sending that. Francis, who had their first meal with the First Lady?
This was a breakfast in Washington. Well, actually, it was referred to as a gala breakfast, which is a rather hideous thought in itself. But anything to do with working breakfasts is pretty ghastly. And this was a working breakfast with Hillary Clinton and over 100 fashion designers in the White House. Can you imagine anything more gruesome? Being invited along to breakfast, and Clinton's arriving, still in their jogging gear, sweating and purple. And this is what Princess Diana had inflicted on her, or whatever she's called these days, Diana, Princess of Wales, HR something.
Not HRH anymore.
No, HR.
HRT.
HRT, that's it. And they don't even get a decent breakfast out of it. Because it's a proper grand breakfast, they have to have fancy nonsense like herbed egg en cocotte with a dash of crayfish and crab and stuff, instead of proper kedgeree and devil kidneys like the rest of us.
It's a lot of stuff to pick off your dressing gown, isn't it? sitting there, popping on their first fags of the day, and past the crayfish, reading the sauce bottles, trying to put things together out of the Kellogg's packet. What a nightmare that must be.
She said she was delighted with her breakfast of eggs with tomatoes, though normally she prefers to have hers with soldiers. Privately, some guests said they were shocked to find it cost them almost £1,000 for each meal with Diana, but then that's less than it cost Charles. Steve, which affair of the heart was at the heart of the matter?
Now, Joan Bakewell, there's a thing. Sometimes a guest, this week a question. This was an extramarital affair which didn't start with the phrase, my wife doesn't understand me. It started with the phrase, my wife doesn't understand my plays. But Joan did, apparently, and it went on for 9 years. And Joan's husband knew all about it, which must have been pretty easy. Just eavesdrop on the phone calls, and if there's a 10-second pause before each reply, you know who's on the other end of the line.
I was rather amused that she was described as the thinking man's crumpet, when the piece of confectionery usually associated with Bakewell is other than crumpet.
Think about it. Laurie, a piece of music for you.
I know the temptation that's been around really all this week has been the temptation for Church of England vicars, and I think that this must refer to the publication of a document advising vicars how to behave, which I thought was a recommendation for them to wear chastity belts at first, because I read it as the greatness of trust, but it was the greatness of trust which actually appeared. And the suggestion was various pieces of advices to vicars on how they should behave. The telltale signs that they were getting too close to a parishioner, for example, that they had sweaty palms or a distended cassock. that was really about the advice to Church of England vicars on how they must behave themselves.
Can I have his question now, sir?
Indeed, was about to award Laurie Taylor 3 points for having answered the question without even being asked it. This is a pamphlet designed to help Anglican priests recognise when they're getting over-friendly with their parishioners. One passage, for example, deals with bodily posture. If you're on your knees but not in church, something may be wrong.
They're worried about drugs, aren't they? They said that you must be very careful not to be on drugs if you're a vicar, and I suppose you know a vicar is on drugs if he starts baptising people with patchouli oil and shoving communion wafers up people's noses.
The guidelines won't apply to the church in Wales, where priests have successfully fought to preserve a uniquely personal relationship with their flock. Alan, who'll be
yes,
left?
This is about the chicken that held up a bank. Walked into the Midland. Sorry.
Alan, who'll be left hard up by a hard back?
By a
hard back.
This is not Peter Gill, the footballer.
No.
I need a clue, Simon. By a hard back.
It's a royal question, Alan.
Oh. It's not Fergie.
Yes, I'm afraid so.
Oh, no, I don't want to do that. This is a book called Fergie, My Secret Life. Can you imagine anything? Very, very, very tiny book indeed has been written. Fergie, My Secret Life. And she, although she is 1.2 million in hot, she still wants to go to court and get an injunction and stop this very, very tiny book being published. It's the story of the grand old Duchess of York, who had 10,000 men. And when they were up, they were up. And they were only halfway up. They all wrote out and published their memoirs.
The Duchess of York has been ordered to lodge £500,000 security as part of her attempt to ban the publication of a book about her life. On hearing how much money the court wanted, she immediately made a large deposit, but then it had been quite a shock. Privately, the Duchess doubts whether she can raise 500 big ones, though that's... I'll leave you to fill in the rest of the joke. And the scores at the end of round two are everybody 8. Francis, how did BB say oui to Jean-Marie?
This is Brigitte Bardot, who is a vegetarian animal rights campaigner these days, having been a sex kitten and gone to the bad. She feels very sad for animals who are neglected. And she's now an active supporter of the National Front in France as well. Mr. Le Pen, another endangered species. She's married one of his advisors. I think she's published her autobiography, saying men are all awful except for the ones in the National Front.
She was the National Front in France for some time.
I don't see why she shouldn't do something now to support Le Pen when she did all those years in her youth supporting Le Penis.
Brigitte Bardot's new autobiography, Initials Bébé. In the book, Bardot expresses her deep admiration for French National Front leader Jean-Marie Le Pen, an omission which was entirely expected given her lifelong devotion to all dumb animals. But we should not be too hasty. The phenomenon of gorgeous, pouting former film starlets being captivated by shady right-wing figures is by no means unusual. Look at Glenda Jackson and Tony Blair. Steve, listen to this piece of music. It's good news week. Someone's found a way to give the rotting dead a will to live, go on and never die. Have you heard the news? What did he say? Why would the balloon go up with nothing on air today?
Aha. This is a very odd story. It transpires, according to yet another book, also available in hardback. It transpires from this particular book that the official policy of the British Chiefs of Staff, the Ministry of Defence, to British submarine commanders at sea is that if Britain is involved in nuclear holocaust and London is raised to the ground and turned into a pile of radioactive ash, the way that you will know this, if you are serving on a submarine, is by tuning into Radio 4. And if the Today programme isn't on, you may assume that the balloon has gone up. Which is an extraordinarily worrying policy. Because, firstly, I thought the whole point of having an independent nuclear deterrent was an immediate response, mutually assured destruction. If anyone dares to fire missiles at us, we fire immediately back. But it now transpires that we have to wait till the next morning.
To see the end of farming today.
To see, yeah. Right, now it's been 10 minutes and it's still just static crackling. Right, go. And also, these people seem to have totally reckoned without the possibility that any British submarine commander might be a Radio 2 listener. They might be flicking around on the dial thinking, where's Terry Wogan, and not know what's gone on. Or Radio 1. I mean, Chris Evans does a lot of road shows. He might be in Cornwall. It might be fine. You know, so what's the weather look like? Well, it's cloudy, but very bright. It seems fine.
You might hear Chris Evans and think, what the hell, and press the button anyway. Laurie, whose moniker was decoded?
Oh, I don't know. I'm having to look around for this. I'm having to glance. We're talking about Inspector Morse, and we're finding out about... this was the discovery that Inspector Morse's first name was Endeavour, which was rather a disappointment, really. But, I mean, it does sort of open the possibility that other people could have their... I rather like the idea of having new names, rather like Endeavour for people. I mean, you know, you could sort of rechristen politicians. I was thinking of sort of the Endearment Bottomley might be rather nice, or Endgame Ashdown, or Endosperm Norris. I mean, they could all...
A droll little letter in the Times. Do you see it about that? Someone, these wags that get flushed out in great cultural moments. And we all know that Morse is this rather lonely bachelor figure. And he said, this bloke wrote to the Times and said, hence the song, one is one and all alone, Endeavour more shall be so. Well, that's all right. Don't want him in the Times regularly, of course. Because he's funny.
Alan, whose labours of love were lost?
This is a very sad story. This is Frank Commode, isn't it?
Yes.
Sir Frank Commode, the distinguished elderly don, decided to move house. And he put on... I mean, it's the pure absent-minded professor story to end them all. It's quintessential, isn't it? And he got all his precious books and manuscripts and things and put them into tea chests. And three men came in donkey jackets and said, what about these then? And Commode said, yes, you can put those on the van. And they were dustmen. They weren't the removal men he anticipated, and they threw him into this thing called a vulture, which goes beep, 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 and backs into your car. And it ate a Lifetime's first edition. I don't want to laugh. Oh, it's terrible. I think he's trying to sue the council for £20,000. Yes. Oh, really very sad. Has it ever happened to you, Professor?
No, it hasn't really, but I mean, I understand that the Dustcart devoured his books with rather more enthusiasm than most of his former readers, but... The very sad story concerns Sir Frank Commode, the man of letters who gave 20 boxes of priceless manuscripts and first editions to the bin men. Normally they expect a pound coin and a sweet sherry at Christmas. Before long, Shakespeare was being pulped for recycling, so now you can get a box of tissues with a different sheet for every act. So at the end of round three, the scores are Francis and Steve 12 points, but Alan and Laurie inching into the lead with 13 points. Francis, some music for you.
How can I ever tell them this is not a puppy love?
Yes, Simon, before you ask any questions, since you're dishing out extra points, it's all to do with quarantine. And there's a Danish consul over here who's in a sulk because his dog was in quarantine and died, and the remnants of this dog were put into an old Maxwell House jar or something. Some coffee apparatus, anyway. Pets win percolators, that sort of thing. And he's now leading a campaign to change the quarantine laws so that little Danish dogs can come into the country at will.
Came back as an instant dog. I sort of wondered if he tipped that stuff out and added a bit of water, whether he got his retriever back.
Bit of a blow. The story refers to a senior Danish diplomat's dog who died while in quarantine and whose cremated ashes were returned to his owner in an instant coffee jar. The diplomat said he wouldn't have minded so much, but he had had three cups before he realised what had happened. The British authorities replied that it would have been much worse if the dog had been rabid. That would have made instant cappuccino. So, 3 points to Francis for getting the answer before the question. Steve, what was on the wing due to trouble on the wing?
I know this question. It's about a house martin.
It is.
Which rather unwisely decided to stage a fight with a cat and unsurprisingly lost, and lost both its wings in the process. Now, I don't know what happens to a bird if its wings are irrevocably. I know when you take it to the vet and it puts its wings in plaster and it kind of has to hop around with solid wings for a few weeks, or whether the vet just fits it with a little sort of hang glider for the rest of its life. Either way, this house martin was found by a kindly person who repaired it, and its wings were fine. But unfortunately, in the interim, whilst its wings were undergoing medical attention, all the rest of the house martins had migrated, because it's that time of year, and this house martin was left here in Britain where it's too cold to be a house martin. And all the others by this time were in Algeria, you know, in the bar, with the Factor 8 on, enjoying themselves. So Air Algeria have offered to fly this house martin to Algeria to join his mates, and then he's going to have a great time. You know, they'll take him up to the flight deck, then look out the window. Oh, this is much easier. I always do it like this. And apparently, all the others have got to fly laboriously down through Spain, avoiding people's shotguns and whatever. And whereas he's going to be there in 3.5 hours, and he's going to be there ahead of all the others. So in fact, he's got the last laugh. He'll be sitting there in the bar first with his new wings and a pint, saying, "Where have you lot been?" So
get your towel down before the Germans. Yes, Merlin the house martin injured his wing and was flown south on a Boeing 737 by Air Algeria, who provided him with a first-class seat complete with in-flight meals and a film. Normally, of course, he'd be sitting on a bundle of twigs with rain dripping on his head while feeding on grubs and insects, but Aeroflot were fully booked. Laurie, where are new seats, not a put-up job?
I think this is Torbay. This is the thing that Torbay have decided to model themselves in the Riviera, and they've decided to ban deck chairs and introduce what they call continental-style loungers, which in view, I suppose, of his European predilections and general demeanour, is a word that would apply rather well to Kenneth Clark, a continental-style
lounger, but anyway, that's... and so they're... So they're trying to make the whole of Torbay rather more continental, and apart from the continental-style loungers, they're going to import 400 bear breasts, 2 gallons of Ambre Solaire, and 1,000 Germans, and then they'll have the whole scene nicely set up.
That's perfectly correct, yes. It's the news that Torbay is to replace its traditional deck chairs with modern German-style sun loungers. Retired residents say there's something new and exciting to do in Torbay every day without modern gimmickry. There isn't really, it's just that they never remember what they were doing yesterday. Alan, who's a pretty boy in 4 different countries?
Oh, it's not a pretty boy at all. It's an extremely nasty boy. It's a budgerigar called Pippin, which can swear in English, French, Japanese, and Afrikaans. It's clearly the most aggressive budgerigar in the world. If you ring its bell, it runs up its ladder and goes 15 rounds with its mirror. You know? it's an extremely nasty Thatcherite. Watching all the wrong movies, listening to all the wrong music.
This refers to Pippin the Budgerigar, who's learnt to swear in 4 different languages. A budgie that can squawk lines from Shakespeare, littered with swear words, has attracted a great deal of media attention, and Channel 4 are going to give it its own series. In many ways, Pippin is just like any other budgie. He can play on his swing, stare at his mirror, and pass for a chicken in Indian restaurants. Before we reveal the final scores, let's see what cuttings the teams have brought along. Francis?
I've brought along a shopping catalogue from a firm called Betterware, which sells all sorts of useful little gadgets and things. But the best thing in it is some, in the clearance bargains, a fun bin, brightly coloured bin for waste or storage. Ideal for small children.
Steve.
It's from a church magazine in Sussex, drawing attention to a notice in the window of an upholsterer in Bear Regis, Dorset, which reads, "Open, weekdays about 9 or 10, occasionally as early as 7, but some days as late as 12 or 1. Closed about 5:30 or 6, occasionally 4 or 5, but sometimes as late as 11 or 12. Some days or afternoons we aren't here at all, and lately I've been here just about all the time, except when I'm somewhere else."
Laurie. I'm always fascinated by social scientific research, you know, I mean, I'm one of the persons who object very much to the idea that sociologists are simply people who go to strip clubs and look at the audience. So I've got, this is from the University of East Anglia, been doing valuable work on a major research project, and they've now revealed that Norwich people are 43 times more likely to die falling out of bed than they are to win the national lottery jackpot. Valuable research.
Alan.
Well, I like this one, Simon, because it was sent to me and the top bit's torn off. But we can sort of guess from the bottom bit what it was about. Or at least I think we can. It says, Farmers Green Southgate Gazette, that Perriman told the court that he was taking a mackerel home for his cat. He had put it in his raincoat pocket because there were important documents in his briefcase which he did not want to smell of fish. It was not his fault that the tube train had lurched several times, throwing him against Mrs. Page. He denied both charges.
Thank you all. Let's look at the final scores. Thanks to the brilliance of the panel in getting answers to questions that they weren't even asked, everybody has 17 points. Before we leave you, here's a cutting from The Guardian sent in by Ted Shepherd of Thirlwell.
A Malaga-based dog food firm cancelled its national search for a human beauty queen when not a single entrant came forward. The company, which advertised the contest... The company, which advertised the contest under the name Bitch of 1996, remains baffled by the lack of interest.
With that, goodbye.
Tonight.
Taking part in the news quiz were Alan Corran, Francis Ween, Steve Punt and Laurie Taylor. The chairman was Simon Hoggart and the news is read by me, Charlotte Green. The chairman's script was by Ian Pattinson with Hugh Rycroft and Adam Bostock-Smith. And the producer was Aled Evans.